Good afternoon. I would first like to apologize on behalf of the court. I think we made the wrong call yesterday to bringing you in today, and Madisonians have not been able to get through the streets until late today. So on behalf of the court, I do apologize to you if we have inconvenienced you or endangered you on your trip here, and hope that your trip home will be easier and not as risky. So on behalf of the court, we do apologize to you. And we hope that our judgment is better in this case than it was on the call that we made. I'll call our third case for today, 09-AP-775, Easy Roll-Off, LLC versus County of Oneida. Pardon me? Oh, I'm sorry. Neither our marshal or our deputy marshal has made it in today, and our acting deputy marshal is a law clerk to Justice Bradley. And are we set to go? Okay. So I will call our case. Thank you, Justice Bradley, for reminding me to see if we're rolling. Is 09-AP-775, Easy Roll-Off, LLC versus County of Oneida. Arguing on behalf of the County of Oneida is Michelle M. Ford, Attorney Ford. Counsel, you may take the podium.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Attorney Michelle M. Ford of Crivello Carlson SC, and I appear on behalf of defendant, respondent, petitioner, County of Oneida in this action. The County of Oneida, and I'll refer to the county as Oneida County, filed this petition for review, which brings this case before this court today, based upon a published decision from the Court of Appeals in Easy Roll-Off versus County of Oneida, case site 2010, WIS App 76. The underlying action centers on an agreement executed on June 25, of 2003 between Oneida County and Waste Management, Inc. The plaintiff appellant, Easy Roll-Off, claimed the agreement was an unlawful restraint of trade as it related to Easy Roll-Off. Easy Roll-Off, however, did not file what is known as a notice of circumstances within 120 days of learning of the contract entered into between Oneida County and Waste Management concerning the transport of municipal waste within 120 days as required by Section 89380 sub 1. The trial court took up the issue of whether or not notice was timely, and Easy Roll-Off argued that antitrust actions under Chapter 133 were subject to a limited exception this court has allowed, which was created in this court's case in State X. Rel. Ocklenleck. And if someone can correct me on that, I'd be really happy to pronounce it correctly, versus Town of LaGrange, which created what the Court of Appeals then interpreted as a three-factor test that they applied to determine whether or not notice of claim requirements should apply to specific actions. We're asking the Court today to review the Court of Appeals decision closely with all due respect to the Court of Appeals and reverse that decision. There are several important issues in this case. On its face, the case appears to hold only that Section 89380 sub 1 and its notice provisions do not apply to antitrust claims under Chapter 133. But by virtue of a footnote put into the Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals actually called into question this Court's decision in Waukesha, DNR versus Waukesha, in which this Court had previously held that Section 893.80 sub 5, which is the statutory exceptions provision of 893.80, created a situation where Section 893.80 sub 1 notice provisions didn't apply to statutory claims. In a footnote, the Court of Appeals essentially said the Waukesha decision was abrogated by the Auchinleck decision, insofar as it held that notice requirements under Section 893.80 sub 1 apply to statutory claims. They do not. So we have a situation that we're presented with here today where we're confronting an issue where municipalities are faced with situations where they face the possibility of having claims brought against them that are created expressly by or read into statutes without having first being served with a notice of claim, notice of circumstances, and an itemization of relief sought as specifically required by Section 893.80 sub 1. And that's the most important issue that we face, I think, today in my in this Council's opinion. We also face the issue of how claims, statutory claims, are to be analyzed for purposes of determining whether or not they fall within the three-factor exception rule to the notice provision statute and whether or not exceptions are warranted. Is it correct to analyze an entire chapter, in other words, Chapter 133, to determine if all remedies provided in that chapter, whether for damages, declaratory relief, or injunctive relief, whether separately stated or not, is it appropriate to apply the exception rule to an entire chapter to analyze whether or not the exceptions apply to all remedies in that chapter? The Court of Appeals said yes and applied the exception rule globally to the entire chapter, even though it contains three separate subsections, one providing for injunctive relief, one providing for declaratory relief, and the third providing for actual money damages. And even though the provision that allows for actual money damages expressly incorporates the provisions of 893.80 to the extent the damage cap is applied to that remedy. And we submit that the Court of Appeals incorrectly analyzed that issue for that reason.
This was a damage case, not an injunction.
Well, that's correct. The trial court asked counsel if his complaint stated a claim for injunctive relief. And counsel stated to the trial court, the trial court stated, I didn't read your complaint as asking for injunctive relief, but perhaps I missed that. Counsel for Easy conceded this point, and he stated, well, maybe it would be better stated as declaratory relief. Counsel for Oneida County, paraphrased Easy Roloff's wherefore clause for the court. The court responded, no, and I quote, no specific request for injunctive or declaratory relief. The court then stated, so it is your position, Mr. Connell, that paragraph A under the wherefore clause, where it says, quote, for an order declaring the agreement described in paragraphs 3, 4, and 8, an illegal restraint of trade under Section 133 is a request for injunctive relief. And Mr. Connell stated, well, I guess if the court declares the contract null and void, we'll be happy. So the trial court walked away with the assumption and with the waiver of an injunctive relief claim under Section 133.16. The Court of Appeals was told on page 13 of the brief submitted by Easy Roloff to the Court of Appeals that injunctive relief was not being sought and had never been sought by Easy Roloff. The Court of Appeals, however, went forward and analyzed the case as if a Section 133.16 claim for injunctive relief had been made, when the trial court had expressly confirmed that it had not been made, It was not alleged in the complaints. There, nowhere in the complaint do you see any reference to Section 133.16. What you see are claims for declaratory relief under Section 133.03 and claims for damages under Section 133.18. But you don't see a claim under 133.16. But the Court of Appeals...
Counsel, let me interrupt you for just a minute. Are you convinced, and if so, on what basis, that there has to be a request for injunctive relief before the Town of Burke test is applicable?
I am, under these circumstances. And the reason is this. Under the Due Process Clause, defendants are entitled to know what is being claimed against them. Plaintiffs are entitled to elect remedies. When an entire chapter provides for separate statutory avenues of relief, as opposed to in the case of the Town of Burke, or in the case of, for that matter, Gillen, where one large statutory section provided for both injunctive relief and other relief, then I think that each subsection, each statutory relief provision, because in this particular case, Chapter 133 defines different procedures for getting that relief, has to be analyzed independently to determine whether or not it fits the exception to the three-factor test. It's not enough that one decides one wants to sue for illegal restraint of trade and just get damages. If that were true, a plaintiff could elect to waive his right, his or her right to injunctive relief, ask for declaratory relief and money damages, and still get the benefit of the exception, even though there's no rationale for applying the exception in that case. Because this Court has made clear that there are certain circumstances, approximately four I identified, under which this Court is more than prepared, or under which courts of appeals and this Court have granted the exception. And those four are, number one, cases in which injunctive relief was the principal remedy. Number two, cases in which the filing deadlines or procedures were directly inconsistent with the 120-day notice requirement. Number three, cases where the limitations periods were sufficiently short to demonstrate legislative intent for immediate relief. Or number four, cases where the action was an appeal rather than an original action.
Well, let me ask you this. How does your position on this case fit with the fact that we have notice pleadings in Wisconsin? Isn't there a tension that develops between your position and the notice pleading provisions of our civil code?
Is there a tension between my position and the notice pleadings
right.
provisions?
It seems to me that you're asking that there be very specific relief requested by the petitioner, plaintiff, whatever the case might be. Doesn't that create some real tension with the fact we have notice pleadings?
Not in this case, because the trial court, I believe, recognized that, which is why the trial court asked counsel for easy roll-off if there was a request for injunctive relief being made in this case. Because I think the trial court full well recognized that when you see a complaint, it typically asks for avenues of relief and cites to statutes, or maybe it doesn't. But it always has that final phrase for such other further equitable relief as may be just and equitable, or something, some words to that effect. Well, the trial court saw that and addressed that issue just before judgment was entered with myself and Mr. Connell to assure the trial court's own mind, what was being pled, what was being claimed. And counsel for Easy Roloff clarified for the trial court that injunctive relief was not being sought. So while certainly you can envision situations where individuals would not plead specific statutes, when the trial court goes and takes the step of identifying the specific claims so to enable the trial court to conduct an analysis of application of the three-factor test. And the trial court knows full well that this court has held that requests for injunctive relief are requests that are accepted from the notice provisions under certain circumstances, Well, then I believe this case is different from cases in which such confirmation, such clarification was not performed. I believe that the trial court asked that question so that the trial court could conduct the appropriate analysis, which would be, I'm looking at each claim alleged, and I'm going to determine whether or not every single claim independently falls within the exception. This would prevent someone from alleging a claim just for damages under Chapter 133. And then, as the law stands, an individual plaintiff can allege just a claim for damages under 133.18, and they do not have to comply with the notice of claim, notice of injury requirements of Section 893.80(1) by virtue of the Court of Appeals decision, because the Court of Appeals lumped all remedies in 133 into one sort of analysis. That's contrary to the Waukesha decision. The Waukesha decision stated the legislature has made it clear. They took the language about torts out of the statute. The notice of claim statute applies to all claims for relief. That's the rule. The exception has to be more carefully analyzed, with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, than was done here.
Counselor, on to a different point just a little bit. It's argued that Oneida County had actual notice of claim, and under 893.80, actual notice is something that takes you out of the statute requirements as long as there wasn't prejudice shown because of it. Could you address your best arguments on that for me, please?
Absolutely. When there's actual notice, then as long as lack of prejudice can be demonstrated, then obviously the notice requirements do not apply and the case can go forward. However, it is not the defendant's burden to prove lack of prejudice. It is the plaintiff's burden to prove lack of prejudice. On this record, the plaintiff made no effort to come forward with any evidence whatsoever establishing lack of prejudice. All that was done was counsel argued, it doesn't appear as though there's any loss of witnesses, any a loss of evidence, any prejudice on Oneida County's part. But arguments of counsel are not evidence of lack of prejudice. And I see this on a disturbing level in connection with practice, where no discovery is conducted so that the plaintiff will actually be able to meet their burden of establishing lack of prejudice. In short, no evidence was presented as to lack of prejudice. It was not our burden. It was theirs. They did not meet it.
Okay. So you do agree, though, that Oneida County had actual notice of this claim?
That's not conceded.
Well, then tell me why you don't think Oneida County had actual notice.
Oneida County didn't have actual notice of the injury and the extent of the injury until the notice of injury and the statement of claim were received on September 28th of 2005, which was several months, over 2 years after the execution of the agreement between the county and Waste Management, and well over 120 days after EZ knew about the effect of the agreement. And while Bart Sexton, the individual responsible for administering the contracts, may have been aware of general concerns that EZ Roloff had about the tipping fees, the county was not put on notice that there was an intent to sue them. So the county really was not in a position to line up, locate, interview witnesses, determine whether or not the claim would have been legitimate until well over 2 years after the execution of the agreement. Actual notice, the
Does
county...
Does it matter at all what the circuit court found? Should we afford those findings any deference?
Well, this is a de novo review. Okay. So, of course, this court... The court defers to the trial court to the extent that factual findings have been made, but the questions of law are de novo.
What were the court's factual findings?
There was no actual notice.
Is that fact or law?
That's fact.
Okay.
I mean, it's factually based.
That's an interesting question, whether or not the notice here comports with actual notice.
Notice to an individual employee of the county is not actual notice to the county. Actual notice typically requires notice to the individual responsible for taking the matter to the county board, for example, or common council in the case of a city, and saying, we have a potential claim for damages on our hands.
Sounds like part of it is legal, though. In your response, you're saying there's an individual, not just an employee, there's an individual, and whether or not the facts of this case meet the legal standard.
Right.
And so isn't it partially a legal question as to actual notice?
It's a mixed question of fact and law. And the question then becomes, is Bart Sexton an individual responsible for, or does he have sufficient responsibility such that notice to him would be notice to the county? And I believe the Vanstone case took that issue up and said that in order for notice to be attributed as actual notice to a county, an individual with sufficient ties to the decision maker who's going to decide on whether or not you have an actual, you're presented with an actual claim that you have to consider as an official body, has to be put on notice. Notice to an employee is not enough. And in this case, the only evidence we have are two meetings with Bart Sexton, in which there was a lot of rattling, but no actual notice that a claim was going to be made. A complaint was filed with other bodies, which would only lead a reasonable employee in Bart Sexton's position to believe that they were seeking avenues of relief other than claims for compensatory damages as against Oneida County.
I'd like to return to your argument, if you're through, Justice Rogenczak, with this area of inquiry.
Oh, sure. That's fine.
I'd like to return to the prejudice and who has the burden of prejudice. You indicated that your opposing counsel argued with regard to no loss of witnesses, no loss of evidence, and made those assertions. But you advance that there is no evidence supporting that. Is it, and as this kind of case, and I used to be involved with these with some frequency, but quite some time ago, do you anticipate that depositions would be taken? I mean, how is opposing counsel supposed to know whether or not you lost a witness or if you lost a particular piece of evidence?
I believe that interrogatories would suffice. A deposition could be taken, but it's not necessary. But certainly some evidence has to be adduced. In this system that we have, we all know that just because lawyers say it so does not make it so.
I'm not saying this is correct, but I'm saying the way that it would often play out, well, I'm not saying it is correct, is that there would be an aversion, not to be confused with, anyway, there would be, they would aver that there was no prejudice, and then the other side would come forward with some argument regarding prejudice, and then the court would determine. And I suppose maybe this is this one of those things where someone has a burden of going forward and another one has the burden of proof? Or I'm struggling and ask for your assistance as how sometimes can they prove an unknown?
Well, in the Vanstone case, the court made clear that it's the plaintiff's burden to prove both actual notice and lack of prejudice. And The only when a party has the burden, the party that must therefore conduct discovery to adduce evidence to meet that burden.
I can't remember ever, for instance, interrogatories might be an approach, but I can't remember anyone doing depositions or anything like that to find out this notice stuff.
I've had that happen frequently. Oh, absolutely. Oh. And I practice municipal law exclusively.
I used to represent the city of Wausau, and that's why I handled a number of these. I just can't remember any of that happening.
Yes. When I raise the notice defense, I'm typically attacked by opposing counsel. Mm-hmm. Not attacked, but obviously countered with interrogatories and questions in depositions, establishing a lack of prejudice. That's routine. So I don't think it imposes an undue burden on the plaintiffs to meet.
Law and practice evolves.
I want to go back to the statute, 893.81, sub 1, and look at it afresh, but also with the case law. This statute is an absolute. No action may be brought or maintained, right? And this is an action which is brought, and it's brought against an entity that's covered here, right?
Right.
So the legislature has said, give them notice, period. It has exceptions, 1G, 1M, 1P, and 8, right?
That's correct.
And this doesn't fall into one of the named explicit legislative exceptions.
That okay. is correct.
So when you approach a case, the I don't like to use the word presumption, but you got to assume it falls within, and then you got to struggle to get it out.
That is correct.
So the court has recognized how you can struggle to get it out, because although it's absolute on its face, you don't interpret statutes to bring about absurd results, and you have to read the statute in context with other statutes. Okay. So is there a specific statutory scheme under 133 that this statute, that is the notice statute, defies or interferes with?
Absolutely. I believe that this case would be completely different if a claim for injunctive relief had been made, had not been waived at the circuit court level, and had not been waived at the trial, at the Court of Appeals level.
I'm afraid I may not have made myself clear. Is there anything in Chapter 133 that if we put notice in, if you required this notice, does that adversely affect a lawsuit under 133?
I understand your question, and I apologize. Absolutely not.
Okay. That's different than the open records case where you start giving notice. The whole point about there is speed. So 133 is a regular statute that has damages, but there are some special provisions. But it's the notice doesn't interfere with it, as far as I could see.
No, there's no facial inconsistency between the exercise of rights under Chapter right. 133, whether it be damages for declaratory relief. And this court has been very strict. Not only does the, in order to meet the three-factor test, there has to be a specific procedure prescribed. It has to be directly inconsistent.
So under the three-part test, really the three-part test is an interpretation of the statute, right?
Right.
Okay. So is there a specific statutory scheme for which the plaintiff seeks exemption? Chapter 133, but I don't know if that's a specific statutory scheme, but it's a statutory scheme, right?
Well, it's a set of three statutory schemes.
I understand that. The next one is, does enforcement of 893.80 hinder a legislative preference for prompt resolution?
There's nothing. The only thing that's being argued is the there's a provision that says these matters shall be expedited. Well, there's a whole number of statutory chapters that allow for expedited remedy. But certainly the statute of limitations is not short. The remedy doesn't preclude the weight of a 120 days to give the municipality reasonable notice. None of the statutory sections are inconsistent on their face with the requirements or the spirit of 893-80-1. So the three-factor test is not met at all as to any of its elements.
And your point there is that 893-80, the purpose is to give the municipality an opportunity to settle this or negotiate.
An antitrust claim is like any other contract tort-based claim. There is absolutely no public policy reason, no legitimate legal rationale for accepting antitrust claims from the notice of the notice provisions of 893-80. None of the four reasons I identified earlier apply.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Connell, James B. Connell, from Warsaw. You're the first one today that's not from Madison or the Milwaukee area, so how are the roads north of here?
They're not bad. We didn't have any snow last night, Your Honor.
Mountain needed it.
Well, we have plenty of snow on the ground, but we didn't get the big snow last night. It was not a bad ride down here, although I was somewhat nervous when I heard about what the weather that we were getting down here. I don't know.
Rightfully so, sir.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Connell, and I represent the plaintiff, appellant, respondent, Easy Roll-Off, LLC. And I ask the court to begin their analysis of this case with two sets of principles or policies. The first is contained in Chapter 133.01, the introductory statute in the chapter on trusts and monopolies. The statute says in part, it is the intent of the legislature that this chapter be interpreted in a manner which gives the most liberal construction to achieve the aim of competition. It is the intent of the legislature to make competition the fundamental economic policy of this state. The second principle I ask you to consider is a statement this court made in a case called Smith versus Milwaukee County back at 149 Wisconsin 2nd, where the court held, in looking at the requirements of the Notice of Claim statute, construction which preserves a bona fide claim so that it may be passed upon by a competent tribunal is to be preferred to construction which cuts it off without a trial. Justice Rogensack asked Ms. Ford about the question of whether there was actual notice in this case. And the evidence, and this is in the file because there are depositions in this case, and they were attached to the motions for summary judgment and affidavits in support of those motions. And the evidence was that my clients, the two owners of Easy Roll-Off LLC, a husband and wife, did not know about this contract that was entered into between Oneida County and Waste Management until February of 2004. At that time, one of their employees, who was at the landfill, saw a receipt that was meant for Waste Management in which the tipping fee of $5.25 per ton was listed. At that time, of course, my clients were paying $54 per ton for the waste they hauled to the landfill. And they looked into it. In the next month or two, they got a contract. They had two meetings with Mr. Sexton, who was the director of waste management, the solid waste director of Oneida County, and the person who, in his deposition transcript, indicates that he is the one that let out the bids, signed the contract, and got the county board to approve it. not only did my clients meet with Mr. Sexton and express their disapproval of this process, but Mrs. Latishier wrote a letter to the District Attorney of Oneida County, to the Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, to the FBI, and a written complaint, which is in the record, to the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And in that complaint to the state agency, she complains that the second part of our complaint is they signed a 10-year contract, and then in parentheses, a monopoly with waste management. We are charged $54 per ton to dump our waste from Oneida County at the landfill. Waste management only pays $5.25 to dump their waste from Oneida County. And she says it's her understanding that it's illegal, that it violates the law. And then she asks for that we be reimbursed the amount we have paid over $5.25 per ton since waste management was paying this amount, which is about $98,000. I also believe this monopoly should be broken and criminal charges filed against all parties involved.
Did you copy the county on those letters? Were they copied?
That complaint was filed with the state agency. Okay. The state agency forwarded to Oneida County, and Oneida County responded. Okay. They had actual notice of this claim, and they weren't prejudiced. Mr. Sexton was deposed, and the deposition transcript, which is part of the file here, indicates his knowledge of the facts of this case. He was the person who negotiated this contract. He was the person who dealt with the complaints made by the Latishiers. He knew about these complaints early in 2004. There is no evidence that any evidence is missing. Witnesses are not available. There just isn't any prejudice in this case. I believe that my clients complied with the notice requirements of Section 893.80. I also believe that in a case like this, that this violation of the law by Oneida County was a continuing violation, that each day that my client's truck and waste management's truck ended up at the landfill and waste management paid $5.25 to drop off their waste products and my client paid $54 per ton to drop off its waste products, there was a violation of Chapter 133. And I believe that notice of claim could have been filed at any time in this case. Now, there is one case that I cite in my brief that I think has some applicability to my continuing violation argument. And it's a case involving the statute of limitations, not the notice of claim. And it's a case called Siegel versus Hurwitz, which is a court of appeals decision from 1983.
The conspiracy case.
That's right. And Mr. Siegel sued two persons from whom he acquired a salvage business. And he had all sorts of theories in his case, two of which were violation of federal and state antitrust laws. And the court, in dealing with those violations in the statute of limitations, cited a series of federal cases that adopt a continuing violation theory of antitrust law when determining limitation periods. Those federal cases all relied upon a United States Supreme Court case, Zenith Radio versus Hazeltine Research. The Court of Appeals found that Mr. Siegel's claims under both federal and state law accrued when the antitrust violations put him out of business, and that he had to file his claims within I think, the 4- and 6-year statutes of limitations for the respective claims. He didn't do so, and his case was dismissed. So under that interpretation, I believe a notice of circumstances, I called it a notice of injury because I haven't adjusted to the new laws, but the notice of circumstances could have been filed any time. It was timely, regardless of whether it's necessary in the first place, and it's timely regardless of whether there was actual notice or any prejudice. The fact of the matter is this illegal competitive activity of Oneida County continues to this very day. It doesn't have any effect on my client anymore, unfortunately. At the time of the deposition in 2008, Easy Roll-Off was out of business. But Chapter 133 still provides that private parties can supplement the government's limited resources in enforcing antitrust laws, and we would like the opportunity to do that. Also, and I know that the county argues that this court shouldn't rely on any federal antitrust cases in construing and applying Chapter 133, but there are many cases, not cases involving the notice of circumstances, but other cases that where the courts of this state have applied federal law in interpreting our own statute. One of the leading cases, I guess ironically, is a criminal case entitled The State of Wisconsin versus Waste Management. I believe that we have a continuing violation. The notice was timely. I believe the county had actual notice. I believe that there is no prejudice, and I believe the Court of Appeals was right when it applied the test or the three factors that were set forth in Town of Burke versus City of Madison. Those three factors being the first, whether there's a specific statutory scheme for which the plaintiff seeks exemption. And in this case, Section 133.16, it wasn't cited by number in this statute, but in my complaint, but it says any circuit court may prevent or restrain by injunction or otherwise any violation of this statute. Although I think under the rules of pleading, these are sometimes thought not to be part of the complaint, but in the addendum clause of the complaint that was filed in this case, we ask for an order declaring the agreement described in paragraphs 3, 4, and 8 an illegal restraint of trade.
If you push that argument too hard, that is there a statutory scheme? I mean, we got 5 volumes of statutory schemes, and many of them just deal with, if there's a violation of sub 1 or sub 2, whatever it is, go to a circuit court, and this is what you plead. So the whole statute book then becomes an exception, or can be viewed as an exception. It seems to me the specific statutory scheme must be tied in with sub 2 as to whether enforcement of 89380 would hinder this statutory scheme, right? I mean, well, they're tied at the hip.
I'm certainly prepared to argue that as well, Your Honor.
Okay.
The second factor is whether it would hinder a prompt resolution. And, of course, counsel has already indicated, not just once, but twice in Chapter 133, there's reference that cases shall be expedited in every way and shall be heard at the earliest practicable date. They shall proceed as soon as may be in accordance with the rules to the hearing and determination of the case. There is a statutory preference for prompt resolution of these claims, and I think that combined with the scheme that provides, I believe, in the section I cited for declaratory relief, it provides for injunctive relief. It makes special provisions for temporary injunctions. Frankly, when I answered Judge O'Melia at the hearing that was referenced by Attorney Ford, I thought he was asking me whether we were seeking a temporary injunction that day. That hearing was a hearing on a motion for judgment on the pleadings that had been filed by the county, which the judge denied. Later, a motion was filed for summary judgment, which Judge O'Melia granted. So I think those two factors favor an exemption of Chapter 133 from the notice requirements of 893-80. And then there's a third factor, which the Court of Appeals referred to as nebulous, which is whether the purpose of Section 893-80 would be furthered by requiring a notice of claim in an antitrust case. And I don't believe the purpose of 893-80. There are problems, I think, with that. One problem is that Judge O'Melia felt that our claim must be dismissed because no notice was filed within 120 days of the contract in this case, which was June of 2003. But Chapter 133.18, subsection 4, provides a cause of action arising under this chapter does not accrue until the discovery by the aggrieved person of the facts constituting the cause of action. Basically, the notice of circumstances time expired before the cause of action accrued, which doesn't make any sense to me. I think there's also something that was mentioned by Ms. Ford about the fact that, and actually she cites the rule of statutory construction, that the I haven't taken Latin for since 1964, but it's expressio.
That was a good year.
Unus
exclusio alteris.
That section, Latin phrase, that is, that the express mention excludes those or implies an exclusion of that which is not mentioned. I think if you look at the last section of Chapter 133, the very last words of the statute, which is 133.18, subsection 6, it says, in a civil action against a person or entity specified in Section 893.80, that's the notice of claim statute, but of course it's more than the notice of claim statute, the amount recovered may not exceed the amount specified in 893.80, subsection 3. In other words, it makes express mention that we will include the provisions that limit the amount of the claim in 893.80, but it says nothing about the notice of injury or notice of claim.
Well, all it does, though, is say that you can have a 133 action against somebody specified in 893.80, and then just limits damages. I bet that language is in other statutes that are similar limitation of damages statutes.
I don't know the answer to that question.
It looks to me, I mean, I think you're making a good argument, but it's also a kind of neutral statute. It doesn't say yes, it doesn't say no.
Well, I brought that up because the county used that in support of their argument.
No.
I thought the same statutory construction, rule of statutory
right.
construction supports the plaintiff as well.
It doesn't look to me as if it supports either one of you. It's just there.
Counselor, you don't really need us to be as broadly stated as the Court of Appeals was in order to prevail, correct? You just need to have us say, yep, they had notice of the claim, and yep, there's no showing of prejudice.
Yes. And I know also that the county's position that this somehow opens the door for all sorts of other claims not related to Chapter 133, I don't think is a necessary thing for this court to address either. I think the court can narrow the claim to the facts of this case, and that's what I'm asking you to do.
Because you led off with that, I'm assuming that's your strongest argument.
The actual
notice and no prejudice.
Frankly, when I walked in this room, I was going to start with this continuing violation argument, but I mentioned the actual notice in part first because it was mentioned by Justice Rogenczak, but I think that we have a good case of actual notice here.
Good. You think that's a question of fact or law?
Well, I think it's a mixed question of fact or law. Here's one of the problems, I think, with Judge O'Melia's decision, is that he was operating from the point of view that notice had to be given to the county within 120 days of the contract. And I have to concede that the contract was signed in June and that no notice was given until these meetings were held in February and this letter was sent to the department in April. They were within 120 days of the plaintiffs discovering what the circumstances were, what this contract was. Now, I think also the county argued, at least in the circuit court, that they should have known, and they cited an ad that was placed in the Rhinelander Daily newspaper twice, once, I think, both of them before contract was entered, but once in April of 2003 and once in June of 2003, that said the Oneida County Solid Waste Department is soliciting bids for the hauling of municipal solid waste, bid specifications, et cetera, and then they tell you where to send it. It's a little square in the newspaper. And the county argued that should have put my clients on notice. But the facts of this case were that Oneida County for many years had operated its own landfill, and Easy Roll-Off and Waste Management, which I think had the city delivery type of pickup for the city of Rhinelander, both would bring all of their waste to the Oneida County landfill. Sometime shortly before 2003, Oneida County decided they didn't want to operate a landfill. And they then decided that they would operate as a sort of a transfer station. All of the waste would be brought to the landfill, but then hauled from there to some third landfill. And Oneida County bought a bunch of fancy trucks so that they could haul this stuff away. And after a short time, they decided, we don't want to do this. And so in 2003, they put out this bid that my client believed was for some company to come to the Oneida County landfill and haul all of the trash of the county to some third place. The contract actually called for a landfill in Ontonagon, Michigan, that I believe was operated by Waste Management, that this trash was to be taken to. What E.C. Roll-Off didn't know, and what we believe is illegal, is when they entered into that contract, the contract for Waste Management to take the trash the refuse, the solid waste material from the Oneida County landfill to Ontonagon, they simultaneously gave Waste Management this tipping fee of $5.25, which was $49.50 less than Easy Roll-Off was paying to the county. And that tying those that agreement together, we believe, is the restraint of trade that ultimately destroyed the business of Easy Roll-Off. And we'd like the opportunity to prove that in a court of law. And so I'm asking that this court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connell. Ms. Ford?
Thank you. First, I'd like to address the facts and the law concerning the notice issue. The facts are actually have to be carefully looked at in the record because the description of the facts now is inconsistent with, I believe, to be the record in this case. Before the execution of the agreement between Waste Management, Oneida County was required to and did put out bids, a request for proposal concerning the trucking and the reduced tipping fee. Altogether, all of the information, including the reduced tipping fee, and that was published as required by statute in the Rhinelander Daily News. They subsequently, Todd and Paula Latisher provided conflicting testimony on their receipt of notice. Todd Latisher acknowledged seeing the public notice and the proposal, which included the tipping fee, but claims not to have been aware of the tipping fee. In other words, the argument here is they saw it, but they didn't understand it, which I think is insufficient as a matter of law to justify an exception to the notice requirement. Oneida County Solid Waste Director Bart Sexton then convened two meetings, and it's undisputed that Todd Latisher attended both meetings and was informed of the transport and trucking arrangements, the lower tipping fee, and other terms of the agreement outlined in the request for proposals and the request for bids. He expressed no opposition to the tipping fee or to any of the terms of the agreement. So I think the record has to be carefully scrutinized to ensure exactly what happened there with regard to notice. Now, with regard to what constitutes notice, the Vanstone case, that it's the plaintiff's burden. Actually, the Marquise case stated that actual notice requires that a governmental entity not only have knowledge of that event for which it may be liable, but also the identity and type of damage alleged to have been suffered by a potential claimant. To fall under the actual notice exception, the claimant must also meet the requirements in WSSTAT section 893.80, and this is the Marquise decision.
Do you agree that Mr. Sexton was intricately involved in this contract negotiation with Waste Management on behalf of the county?
He was involved in the posting of the request for bids, but he didn't have the authority to approve the contract.
Well, probably the county board is the only one, or the executive would
exactly
be the one
right
with the authority. But if you're going to go that far for notice, I don't see how you ever deal with the statute.
The circuit court based its decision on the fact that threats by the Latishers to terminate business with Oneida County contained in the complaints that they filed with the various bodies did not constitute actual notice of a claim for relief sought or a claim that litigation was impending. That was important to the trial court. It's one thing to receive complaints from citizens regarding action that governmental officials take. That happens all the time. It's another thing entirely to be put on actual notice that you are facing a lawsuit and you must muster your forces or analyze the claim for purposes of settlement. With regard to the actual notice, counsel here has conceded by virtue of his argument that there was no evidence of lack of prejudice. But it's his burden to produce.
Well, what about the depositions that he talked about? Isn't that something that's evidentiary?
Exactly. He referred to depositions, but nowhere in those depositions did he adduce evidence that there was no prejudice. He didn't ask those questions. He didn't adduce that evidence. And so he stands up here to you today again and gives solely arguments of counsel and makes the statement that no evidence of lack of prejudice, he wants you to this court to hold that no evidence equals an affirmative lack of evidence. These are two separate concepts.
I agree with that. I'll have to go back and read the depositions because I didn't do that, but I will. What would you think he would have had to have shown to show no prejudice? You're asking him to prove a negative, you realize.
Well, the typical questions that you hear asked are what witnesses no longer work for the county? Identify the individuals who have material knowledge, who are no longer available. You're really looking for any facts that establish a loss of witnesses, a loss of documents, a loss of evidence to the municipality. And these are typically the questions that are asked during the course of the depositions that I defend on this particular issue.
Okay, thank you.
So, counsel, does the record indicate, as Mr. Connell, when he held up that copy of the advertisement, I assume it was some distance away, but it appeared to be within the context of what he was saying, the advertisement in the Rhinelander newspaper, that the city of Rhineland, that the county was looking for a contract it appears to me the main context or the main point of the contract would be to haul the waste away from Rhinelander to someplace else, and this
right.
It happened to be Michigan. So Waste Management wound up getting that contract. Did Waste Management then become, does the record show that whether Waste Management then became obligated to haul all of Oneida County's trash to Michigan, solid waste?
Yes.
So does the record indicate that as part of that, as part of the contract, that there would be a more favorable tipping rate?
No. What the county did was when it put out the request for bids that was published, it invited all haulers, including but not limited to Easy Roll-Off and Waste Management, to operate under the same terms which provided for the tipping fee. Easy Roll-Off simply failed, dropped the ball on the request, and didn't submit a proposal. So Easy Roll-Off is now asking this court to cure that situation by holding Oneida County somehow responsible for not making them fully understand what the request meant, when we were very clear that the tipping fee would apply regardless of who the contract was assigned to.
Okay, but the tipping fee is to dump waste into the landfill, right?
Into the Rhinelander.
The same terms.
Okay, I understand that. But I guess, you know, his complaint is you couldn't make this kind of a contract. It wouldn't matter if you made it with his client or your or Waste Management, that it's illegal tying to tie the tipping fee into one facility with a contract to haul stuff to Michigan. I think that's his claim.
That's his.
So it doesn't matter whether he knew about it or not. I mean, I don't know what the merits of this is going to be, you know, if he were trying to prove it. But what he's saying is you couldn't do that. So it doesn't matter whether you said you were going to do it in the paper or not. That wouldn't make it legal if it's illegal.
Well, but that's a request for declaratory relief, to which this court has repeatedly held notice of claim and the notice of claim requirements apply. And again, the lack of prejudice by virtue of a counsel statement is not the same as an affirmative evidence of the lack of prejudice.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, and I will look at the depots.
My red light's on. I might have to stop here unless the court has any.
Are there any questions? Having none, do you have a one-minute summary that you want to give?
I did want to address if I have, I think this is a very important case, not only from the perspective of whether or not this court will again address and keep restrictive the exceptions to the notice of claim rule, because I believe this court this court's decisions are consistent and sufficiently restrictive to allow for correction of the Court of Appeals analysis. I also think this case is an important case and allows this court the opportunity to more specifically define the burden that is created upon plaintiffs to come forward with evidence, actual evidence, of lack of prejudice, as is the rule in Wisconsin, so as to avoid the situations that we see over and over again, where a circuit court is faced with an attorney's simple statements that the municipality was not prejudiced without any evidence whatsoever. These two issues are very important, and resolving these issues in favor of Oneida County would result in dismissal of this action. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Ms. Ford and Mr. O'Connell in another argument relating to 893.80 sub 1, section that's given the court difficulties in the past and continues to do that. Especially want to thank you for coming here today under these adverse climate conditions. So thank you. That concludes our hearing in 09-AP-775 Easy Roll-Off versus County of Oneida. And the court is in recess and will be in closed conference at 10 after 3. And we will come back in here for oral argument tomorrow. Court is in recess.